Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. We're back with our roundtable to discuss the week in Washington and beyond. Joining us today are Dr. Gordon Adams of the Quincy Institute Think Tank, Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners, Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute, former Pentagon Comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who among his many hats is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, as well as our very own producer, Chris Cervello, a retired United States Navy commander and former public affairs officer who is also the co-founder of the Provision PR firm. Everybody, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. Mackenzie, thanks very much for joining us. You're pinch hitting for our normal congressional correspondent, Ironmark Herson, who couldn't join us this week. Where are we on the stimulus deliberations as well as broader budget deliberations? Obviously, we hear a lot of folks talking about, again, the ills of operating on a continuing resolution, but I think folks want to avoid a government shutdown. The president is steadily moving closer to where House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is in terms of a much larger fourth stimulus package. She's put a marker down for $2.2 trillion. That's much, much bigger from what Michael discussed last week in terms of the GOP's skinny stimulus approach that was somewhat more about covering butts through elections to be able to say we tried to do something. Where are we now, and what are your sources on the Hill telling you about how this is going to be playing out over the next week?
I will do my best, Michael, but let me know if I fall short. First, it's National POW MIA Recognition Day to honor more than 80,000 service members who remain listed as missing in action. So we honor them this morning. So,
and we should also wish a happy birthday to the United States Air Force, by the way, as it's September 18. But anyway, you were perfect. Saying.
So the good news is a government shutdown appears almost entirely unlikely. And that's actually progress, I think, in Washington after this summer. That's good news. But, you know, there's not going to be enacted appropriations anytime soon. We will start the fiscal year on October 1st under a continuing resolution, which is, you know, spending frozen at last year's levels. It has a variety of restrictions for the Pentagon in particular. I'll get to that. The good news is that the Treasury Secretary has already agreed with House Speaker Pelosi that the continuing resolution will be clean. It'll be free of policy riders. Those are usually considered poison pills that sink the bill. So that's actually a big step. What's unclear is if there will be any sidecar stimulus attached to that CR. A week ago, it seemed entirely impossible. And now there are glimmers of hope, partly because, as you said, Vago, the president has weighed in on this with tweets and remarks at his press conferences. This week, he's saying that Republicans should go for higher numbers, as in from their own two stimulus bills they've proposed, the skinny and then the other, the one before that, earlier this summer. And he's supporting, in particular, direct payments to Americans again. And so, right, the difference here is basically the House Democrats have come down to $2.2 trillion, saying that's, you know, our bottom line. And the Treasury Secretary has said that the GOP and the White House, well, unclear who is the proverbial we, but in negotiations, he could support up to $1.5 trillion. That's not, I know it's a lot of money, but it actually isn't too far apart. So I'm optimistic, potentially. The White House Chief of Staff told the press this week that he's more optimistic about a deal, the potential for a deal in the last 72 hours than he has been in the last 72 days. The White House press secretary talked up a proposal that was unveiled by the Problem Solvers Caucus, which is 50 lawmakers in the House from both parties. Their proposal is $1.5 trillion. Now, the issue here is the sticking point for the White House is in that proposal and in others, $500 billion for state and local governments. The White House has said they want that funding removed. And so the talks are real, and they're back in action after really languishing for months. So regarding the continuing resolution, the White House, like I said, the House Rules Committee will meet on Monday, which means the CR, this continuing resolution, will be set up for a vote in the House midweek. I expect the Senate to move very quickly after that. And again, we'll start the year without a shutdown. The White House is seeking what they call anomalies for the CR for several federal agencies, but if, you know, the Pentagon is tops because they are so adversely impacted, as Dr. Zach Heim and others on this call know. They're seeking, in particular, I'd highlight a second Virginia class submarine, the new Space Force, which has to basically stop standing up entirely because their money is going to come from the Air Force, and they can't do that under a spending freeze, as well as a new submarine launched nuclear warhead, for example. It's unclear where the anomalies request will go in the CR. The Congress has not been very helpful to the Pentagon in recent years in granting these exceptions, of meaning this bill prohibits new starts and expansion of existing programs, and the Defense Department usually doesn't get what it wants when it asks for this. So lastly, we had the House and Senate Armed Services Committee chairman both say this week, you know, they expect no defense authorization bill until after the election. They're not really in a hurry. And the House has said they're not even going to appoint conferees until November. Of course, the staff is busy pre-conferencing everything. And once the elections are over, the bill will pass quickly.
And, you know, it's worth pointing out that at the end of the day, everybody here is a politician, and they realize exactly how bad the situation is right now. You know, so it doesn't matter whether or not, you know, Democrats passed their measure 4 months ago. And you know, I mean, a lot of this has been, as we've discussed on this podcast over many, many months, you know, the disarray has been a little bit more on the GOP side of things. At the end of the day, people did lose those benefits. I think there is a palpable concern, and it's even being reflected in the market, that the economic pain is actually to come. Byron, let me bring you in at this point. We were going to start off talking about Treasury outlays that came out after we spoke last week, but that's really been superseded. Talk to us about how you're seeing stuff up on Capitol Hill.
Well,
and
yeah,
how that's going to affect the picture.
Absolutely agree with all the good points that Mackenzie made. I just add a couple of things to kind of riff off her comments. You know, I think the biggest gap between Republicans and Democrats seems to be over state and local relief. The House initial proposal, I think, had about $900 billion in it. And the Republicans have been looking at something close to $100 billion, but that's kind of repurposed money for, you know, that's already been appropriated in some ways. So I don't know where that gap gets closed. There's kind of an interesting higher level debate about just how bad state and local finances are. You've got BEA data that suggests that, hey, maybe things aren't so bad, but some of the associations, the National Association of County Managers has had some data about, you know, depending on the state, some pretty substantial declines in their fiscal 21 budget. And I know this is all tangential to defense, but I think it's important to call out because it's a debate that people should keep an eye on. Really, what is the health, the fiscal health of these state and local governments? And I think the other thing, maybe a slightly positive note, if there is a deal, sounds like there might be some money for airline relief. I know that's not a direct impact on defense, but it might tangentially help commercial aerospace, and obviously commercial aerospace and defense in many ways are kind of joined at the hip if you look at how the two industrial bases feed off one another.
We've heard that message, Byron, and that's a really great point because Navy Acquisition Chief Hondo Gertz, for example, has said how closely they're watching the commercial side of the industry for potential impact, certainly on the Navy's aviation programs. You know, the state and local aid is really, really important because during the last economic crisis, a lot of the biggest job losses happened at the state and local level, where whether it was firefighters or any number of, you know, police, municipal workers were the ones who lost their jobs. And there was a little bit of a delay in the recovery from that standpoint. Gordon, let's go to you and then Dove, get your take on this as well. Go ahead.
Well, as we have, a number of us have been saying on this podcast for some time, I'm shocked to learn there's politics going on in this joint. We are in the middle of an election campaign, so almost any decision but one, I'll come back to that, is being impacted by this very unpredictable election campaign that's going on. I think that's what's pushed the CR forward. Nobody wants to be blamed for a government shutdown in the middle of this election campaign. I think it's what's pushing the politics of the stimulus. What's interesting here in particular to me is that Pelosi is also being pressured on this. The White House is obviously feeling the pressure, and the president has called for a big number. But Pelosi is also being told by her caucus that they are running in places where, you know, getting a deal and saying the Democrats are moving forward on this is going to be important to their electoral fortunes. So politics is infused throughout this entire conversation. The only exception, I think, and here I may differ a little bit from my good friend Mackenzie Eglin, is that in general, the Pentagon and the Hill have a pretty good conversation about anomalies. And I expect the kinds of things that she identified that are the anomalies for the Department of Defense are very likely to end up in the extended CR. And then the only question is going to be how long that CR is going to be for. It sounds like pre-Christmas is the likely deadline everybody's going to agree on. Some Democrats want to go to February. I don't think that's likely to happen. But I think keep in mind that almost all of these decisions are not on the technicalities, they're on the politics.
Let me pick up where Gordon left off. My guess is that because there's so much pressure on different elements of the defense budget, that there will be some exceptions, maybe not as many as the DOD wants, but there will be some. Particularly the Space Force, it's embarrassing if you've announced the Space Force and you voted for it and then you're not putting a penny into it. So that one might get passed. The Democrats aren't going to want people saying, oh, you killed the Space Force. You know, it's kind of like who lost China? You just don't do that. It's interesting and it makes sense that the authorizers have decided to wait until after the election. Especially if Biden wins, what normally happens, I know Gordon will remember this, every outgoing administration raises the budget as much as it can on the defense side and to lock in as much as it can the next administration's first year. I remember this when I was comptroller, they were going in the other direction. They tried to lock me down and we added up, but they're always trying to lock.
Gordon, I know you've got an intervention you want to make, and then I want to bring Chris into this as well, because he's got some thoughts on it, and then bridge us into our next topic, which was Dr. Esper and the Navy's shipbuilding plan. But go ahead, your ad.
Yeah, just a quick comment that I don't really expect, whether it's Biden or Trump, to try to push back on the 21 number, the fiscal 21 number. I expect that'll go through pretty much as everybody has agreed so far it should. The real game is going to be around the 22 number, and I don't, if Biden wins and Trump loses, I don't expect the Trump administration to come in with a developed budget request at a specific number to embarrass the Democrats, at least if history is any indication of that. I don't expect that particularly to happen.
Chris?
Well, if you're talking history, I got to correct you. In 76, that's exactly what the Ford administration did. That's exactly what Bush 41 did when Clinton came in. So sorry, Gordon.
No, it's not what, I'm sorry, I have to disagree, Dove. It's not what Bush 41 did. Bush 41 came in with a current services document. And yes, it was reduced from the current services document, but it was not a full budget request. It was not a prepared.
Oh, yeah, well, neither did the Obama. That's a game that's been played as well. The Obama people did that to me. They didn't come with a formal request. They just came out with a number that put tremendous pressure on me. But that's okay, Gordon. We can disagree.
We're going to have to disagree technically.
wait a minute. How did the Obama people do that, Dove? You were already gone by then.
No, I'm sorry. Not the Obama people, the Clinton people. My apologies. So Bill Cohen comes in with $312 billion, if I recall. The thing was, though, that it wasn't finalized. So there was a lot of game playing as to whether this was the real number or it wasn't the real number. And as it happens, OMB, which didn't want us to raise the budget, said, no, 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 the Cohen number is the real number, which was the kind of pressure that the Democrats were hoping to put on us. And Rumsfeld simply went to the president and said, it ain't going to work. And the president agreed with Rumsfeld, much to the chagrin of OMB.
Chris, let me bring you into the conversation at this point. You've got a final point to make on the budget, but then also take us to Defense Secretary Esper, Esper's guidance that we need a Navy that's bigger than 355 ships, and his plan, something which has already come under some pretty sharp criticism from a lot of different quarters.
Yeah, I simply was foot stomping on what Gordon said. Unfortunately, as painful and as disruptive as CRs had become for the Pentagon, my experience working on the Navy staff was is that when the Navy needed something and they went to the Hill, they were on the big stuff, especially stuff that was important to individual members, they were able to find accommodation, which was kind of frustrating because it just simply allowed that CR mindset to continue. The pain wasn't painful enough to really drive folks to actually pass a budget because they were able to find accommodation. So either way, as everybody has said, this really stinks for the services and for the Pentagon as they try to kind of tiptoe their way through the first several quarters of the year.
Let's transition to the Navy document. What are the salient elements of this? Because I kind of want to go around the table and certainly get Dove's take on it as somebody who's been on, also has advised Center for Naval Analyses as well as numerous, actually 4.5 decades of advice to chiefs of naval operations.
So, without, geeking out for the audience, essentially the Secretary of Defense in his westward swing this past week came out and officially opined on the work that the Navy and his staff have done over the last 8 to 10 months. And basically what he said is yes, the Navy needs a larger, more capable fleet in the range of 350 ships. Those ships need to be smaller, and they need to incorporate more and newer technology as opposed to what we have now. Now, initially, among the navalist crowd, everybody sort of, at least cheered that idea. And then as you start to pick at the prepared remarks and the remarks that were actually given, it's unclear where that 2% increase will come. Does the Navy eat that 2% increase out of hide? Is there going to be an increase in the Navy's top line budget? Where does it will the other services give money to that 2%? And so that initial high was followed by a bit of a down. As there, really what this did was create more questions. The last point I want to make is, and what is particularly frustrating to me is, Secretary Modley in December, when he assumed the role of acting Secretary of the Navy, he pushed very hard on the uniformed folks who had pretty much sat on their hands for the first two or so years of the Trump administration on putting together a workable plan to get to 355. He pushed them very hard. He asked them for a plan to grow the Navy to 355 in 10 years. They put that plan together. He presented it to Secretary Esper. Secretary Esper, by all accounts, had more important things to worry about. And then now what you see 8 months later is essentially Secretary Esper putting forth a less perfect but very similar version of what was proposed eight months ago. So it's kind of frustrating for those of us that follow this because it's not very realistic. It lacks the granularity that would be needed for it to be taken serious either in a Trump 2 administration or in a new Biden administration.
And what was laudable about what Tom was trying to do was to move with the kind of urgency that we're now seeing from C.Q. Brown and the Air Force leadership, right? Last week at the Air Force Association's virtual airspace cyber conference, that was actually one of the biggest messages that were driven forward, was this accelerate change or lose document. And I commend everybody to read it, because unlike, it's not a book, it's not a ponderous document. It's you know, I mean, you know, with cover piece and everything else, it's 8 pages, 4 of which is real dynamite. Dov, let me go to you and get your sense on where we are on the plan and how we effectively pay for it, because there is a growing sense that we're going to have to make trade-offs, right? One of the messages, again, the entire Air Force leadership was driving forward, and Chief Brown was driving forward, was, you know, we're going to have to take risk. We're going to have to move faster. We're going to have to make choices. There are a lot of folks who are already talking about the importance of air and airspace and sea power in the Pacific, and maybe a bigger role and no less critical for the Army, for example, to become the iron core of the European Russian deterrent force. As much as the Army might not be as crazy about it, but certainly we'll hear more at AUSA. What's your sense on the plan that Dr. Esper finally released and whether it's executable?
Well, he hasn't really released the plan yet. Here's where things stand. At the end of last week, Kate, the program analysis shop, finished its work. It sent up to the secretary its report, with 3 alternatives, which is typical. So you want to really know what the middle alternative is. One would be higher, one would be lower. I spoke to a number of very, very senior people in the department this past week, and here's what I've got. They, first of all, the emphasis is all on the Pacific. I think you're absolutely right, Vago. The Army is not going to be happy. They've been trying to play in the Pacific, but as one very senior DOD person said to me, you've already got the Marines. And of course, the Commandant has a very, very interesting approach, innovative approach to how to fight the war in the Pacific. So that's number one. Number two, there seems to be a sense that they have to hit 355. The question, of course, is, okay, how do you do it? Apparently, and this is was told to me sometimes directly, sometimes less directly, there's going to be a huge emphasis on counting stealth ships. What kind of stealth ships? You know, the Navy's been playing with that. How big, how small? That has to be worked out. Clearly, the big loser in this is going to be the aircraft carrier. That's where you're going to see most of the opposition to this plan. But again, as a very senior person said to me, $15 billion is an awful lot to keep on spending year after, you know, time after time. So I think what Esper was hinting at, more than hinting at, but without getting into specifics, is that they are expecting that they will come out with a quite radical change. And again, as somebody said to me, you know, most of the Navy leadership, they've grown up with the aircraft carrier. It's been 70 years and it's been very successful. It's going to be very hard to change. Let me just tell you one other thing, though, Vago. You said I was affiliated with CNA. I never speak for CNA on any of these matters.
Understood. Your opinions are wholly your own.
Wholly my own. H-O-L-Y. Quite right.
Yes, on this New Year's weekend, that's certainly worth remembering. And Shana Tova for everybody, you know, for Rosh Hashanah. Mackenzie, why don't you weigh in now, and then we'll go to Chris and then Byron to finish up this point and move on.
Dr. Zachman laid it all out very well. The CAPE plan essentially reduces the emphasis on carriers and increases it on, you know, unmanned vessels. And what did you see this week from Navy leadership, different civilian and uniform leaders across the Navy? They were doubling down on aircraft carriers. No coincidence, I'm sure. It was their indirect response to Secretary Esper and the decision point coming at, you know, soon, meaning where he will choose one of the plans and then make it public. So you saw the admiral in charge of fleet forces saying that China's pursuit of more aircraft carriers validates the Navy's commitment to aircraft carriers long into the future. And then it was leaked or noted that the Navy's considering an extension of the service lives of the Nimitz class, the earlier aircraft carriers of the Nimitz. And I think both of those are attempts to shape the secretary's decision as he moves forward.
I know that there were some people who were regretting Enterprise going out of service, in part because she still had a lot of mileage in her. Chris?
And then I have to make a correction. It just occurred to me because I said stealth ships. Mackenzie's right. What I meant were the unmanned ships.
Understood. No problem. Thanks for the clarification, Dove.
Okay.
Chris, why don't you take it away, and then Byron, let's wrap on this point.
Sure. Two very quick points to piggyback. One, Admiral Grady probably gets the black star for the week. I mean, that what a ridiculous comment for the head of Fleet Forces to make, to make the carrier argument juxtaposed to what the Chinese are doing in terms of shipbuilding. Not really the message that that you want to see out there. The second point is all of this discussion, in my opinion, reinforces why a ship number, whether it's manned, unmanned, is imperfect in terms of quantifying the type of force that you need in the future. It pushes you down rabbit holes of the counting tricks that we saw during the Mabus years. It pushes you down the carrier versus this or whatever, instead of actually looking at readiness and ace of O number, for those that are familiar with that, how many ships are actually ready instead of how many ships we have in the inventory. And then what is the capability of that ship to actually do what you want, or of that aircraft or of that cyber system. And so hopefully as these conversations move forward, we will eventually mature to something that is a more complete metric and way of understanding what capability is.
I'm glad you mentioned that about Admiral Grady, highly competent leader. But I mean, it was kind of a stunning, you know, you never want to make the case why your adversary should be building capability as a way of sort of justifying it on your own. I mean, the argument should be, how is the United States Navy making and keeping the carrier relevant? It's not just about building carriers. And the concern folks have is we are not maximizing the value of that investment as a strategic deterrent and warfighting tool. Byron, let me go to you and then ask you also to bridge to the fascinating Navy League event on this, the start of the 400th anniversary of the crossing of the Mayflower with 135 souls aboard from Plymouth, England, departed on September 16 in the revised date in 1620 with 135 to what became Plymouth Colony. And IBM has this fascinating Mayflower project, which I'd like you to talk about as well. But why don't you wrap up on the Navy point before taking us to the New World?
Well, no, I think because they're really intertwined. I think the central point is, you know, this whole leap to unmanned or uninhabited surface and undersea vessels, it, you know, it's still very much a work in process. And I think a lot of this came out during the AUVSI conference the week before last. There were some excellent presentations by naval officials about, you know, some of the very practical day-to-day issues that they're encountering in what's really a very limited experimental force at this point in time. The Mayflower project you mentioned, you know, was supposed to sail this fall. COVID-19 has delayed it to the spring. I would recommend people look at the video just to kind of get a sense of what this is about, and also where the state of the art is right now. The idea is to send an uninhabited vessel across the Atlantic. And obviously that's going to be through some very treacherous weather and through shipping lanes as well, you know, that'll make that crossing without any human intervention. And I think that's going to be an important point in this case. The vessel, you know, the intent and IBM's intent really seems to be framed more around oceanography research, but clearly, you know, proving out some of the systems, the automation systems, the autonomous captain effect on that.
The AI captain, the artificial intelligence captain.
Correct, yeah. That will have implications for you know, what the state of the art could be for the Navy going forward. And I think, you know, there really are a whole range of questions here about how secure are your networks, how effective are these things are going to be in heavy weather. During the AUVSI sessions, one person mentioned that kelp or seaweed is basically a problem. When you operate a vessel this long at sea, it can foul your propellers or even your sensors. So there are all these very practical issues. And I think as much as we're having this debate about future force, and I absolutely agree with Chris, the comment about what you're counting here, I think is very important. And in turn, that should really drive you to the capability that you're going to deliver. But just settling on a 350 or 355 container number, you know, you really need to know what's in those containers and what their capabilities are. And I just don't see this debate being resolved until you really get a firmer grip on what exactly the capabilities these unmanned, uninhabited systems are.
You're sounding a lot like Bob, former Deputy Defense Secretary Bob Work, in kind of making that point. I mean, and I think anybody
Vago. I mean, the point I'd make is you have to actually. What I would like to see is the Navy put a lot more emphasis, just buy more ships of this caliber, of these different classes, and get them out there and experiment with them. I mean, we really seem to be limited, working with a fairly limited number. And actually, if you looked at the I think it was the House markup, they cut funding for some of these systems in the FY21 budget. So right. That was a little bit, you know, opposite of the direction that personally I think we ought to be headed here.
And I think everybody can learn from the way the Air Force has done this, right? I mean, Dr. Roper's point on the NGAD, the Next Generation Air Dominance Fighter, taking it from an electronic design, testing subsystems on multiple other platforms, integrating it into an airplane, flying it and setting records and doing it by all accounts with extraordinary speed, but also with not a lot of money. Certainly a lot of lessons to be drawn. I want to move on. Time is getting tight. We've got still a lot of stuff to cover. First, Chris, didn't plan to do this, but I want to ask a quick election messaging thing. And it was based, Chris and I have morning calls and we try to cover a lot of things. And I thought that, you know, the presidential race seems to be in an inflection point. President has been throwing a lot of stuff at the wall and it doesn't appear to be sticking. And very quickly, just get your guys' sense on messaging, especially on national security insofar as it matters or doesn't matter. Because increasingly, we've been seeing that some of the things that the president appears to be doing on China and talking about China is actually to make up for the fact that he personally has not been as strong on China, certainly been focused on the economic component. But Chris, talk to us a little bit about what some of your takeaways are as a professional communicator and what our very attuned Washington crowd is also picking up as well very quickly, because I do want to get to Taiwan and a couple of other issues before we wrap. Go ahead.
Sure. While I don't believe that either candidate is really overtly, going after or using a holistic national security message, they have sort of, as they've tweaked these their messaging heading into the election, you know, a month or so out, you are starting to see different elements of it. If you watched the event last night with Vice President Biden, there was a very clear, Scranton versus Fifth Avenue message that he is using as a way of pushing back on this idea or belief on the right that the president is the voice or the force for the little guy. And he made very clear why his background is very different than Trump's. And that is what they, if you listen to their surrogates, that is what he is going to push over the next couple weeks. In addition to that, they are really doubling down on the digital side with this idea of losers and suckers being attributed to President Trump. The comment losers and suckers reported first by The Atlantic, and then there's been other reporting. And so there'll be a number of digital ads in heavy military and heavy military retiree communities that really point out that message and kind of make Vice President Biden seem to be the friend of the military. On the Republican side, you see President Trump realizing that this law and order messaging is not really working as effective as he would like it to. And so the thought is you'll start to see him double down on the economy and how he's handled other countries in a way to protect American jobs and tariffs and all the things that you've heard him say over 4 years. So while not directly related to national security, the tangents as the messages continue to be refined certainly have a connection.
The military issue here right now seems to be playing as a complete win for the Democrats. The president has put himself, frankly, in a very difficult position with all of the reporting that's now gone on about the comments that he's made. The law and order message, it's a little bit less clear to me because we have to keep in mind that the competition here is not just for voter turnout, it's the key state issue. It's the swing state problem. And the president is now, I think, going to Wisconsin for the fourth time, going to parts of Wisconsin that are friendly to him, and he's doubling down on the law and order message in Wisconsin. So depending on how tight the race gets in Wisconsin, that message could play in swing states in a way that it doesn't need to play nationally.
and he's 9 points down, by the way, in Wisconsin. And he also announced $13 billion more in subsidies for farmers, which under any stretch of the imagination would be somewhat outrageous, because farmers, you know, are not particularly different than anybody else who's having economic impacts.
Yeah, I would just add, I'm inclined to agree with Gordon. I think his target in terms of fear and law and order are the suburbs. He wants to get he believes, whether he's right or wrong, I don't know. I mean, I live in a suburb, and my suburb, he's wrong, but who knows? He believes that he can get the suburban housewives in the marginal states that, you know, went for him last time, and he's not sure about this time, by essentially telling them, if you vote for the Democrats and Biden, they will start public housing in your suburbs. I'm not saying that's what's going to happen, but that's what he's trying to convince people will happen. And so I don't think he's given up the law and order thing at all. And I think it's just targeting. In some places, it'll be the economy. And in some other places, it's going to be law and order. As for the military, yeah, my sense is that it's going to be hard for him to walk this cat back. He's got a problem. He has said things about veterans, and about prisoners of war, about General Mattis, about McCain. It's all piling up. And it just seems to me that, yeah, there will obviously be some folks in the military who would vote for him, you know, as he would say, whether he shot somebody on Park Avenue or something like that. But for many of the military, most of whom, as far as I recall, are independents anyway, he has really come up with some bloopers.
Look, I mean, I think the even the notion of sort of the suburban housewife in 2020 is, you know, absurd, and suggests you're still living in 1952. And I don't know how many people are still living in 1952. Very quickly, anything anybody else wants to add?
Well, Vago, the president is living in 1952. Let's be very clear about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been my sense, is that his view of American power, it's as if the United States is Eisenhower's America, you know, standing astride the world as the economic, diplomatic, and military superpower. And that's, you know, that's just not the case. Dove, I want to start with you, and then Gordon, get your take on this as well, because both of you raised this as an issue worth discussing. There is bipartisan concern across the Washington policy community and among lawmakers that China may try something unfortunate with Taiwan now that it's succeeded in sort of asserting its will in Hong Kong. There's another large package that's up on the Hill. It's said the president is backing this in part because he sees, you know, it's a way to, again, appear tough on China. Walk us through what's in the package and why it's so important.
Well, there are seven elements to it. The most prominent ones are drones. I think they're Reapers. There's the HIMARS artillery rocket system. There's the Harpoon naval missile. There are mines to make it much more difficult, if not impossible, for an amphibious landing. And I should say that when I visited the Chinese War Museum in Beijing, they have a complete mock-up of an amphibious landing on Taiwan. Well, those mines are going to make it much harder. So what you're seeing here, something we haven't seen in decades, which is not only are we not stalling on a Taiwanese request, we are moving as quickly as possible. And of course, it's going to send a message to Beijing. It's going to reinforce Taiwan's own sense that it can go its own way. And as you said, Vago, this is bipartisan, which, again, is something really quite different from where we've been in the recent past.
Gordon, I want to bring you in, but I also want to point out that Reuters is reporting Taiwan's defense ministry said on Friday that multiple Chinese Air Force jets crossed the midline of the Taiwan Strait and also into Taiwan's southwestern air defense identification zone on Friday, and that Taiwan scrambled fighters to monitor their activities, the ministry added. Gordon, go ahead before we wrap up the
show. Yeah, I think that was basically right here. The one he didn't mention is the SLAM extended range, which is something that the Taiwanese would be capable of deploying on the F-16s that they're going to buy from the United States. And that gives them, at least on paper, the opportunity to actually deliver capability to the Chinese mainland. So it is a serious escalation. Note, too, it's important that there, politics is never absent from these kinds of proposals and decisions. So we're going to see a game, I think, over the next month of who's going to be tougher on China. And this is certainly timed, at least, with a sense that there may be some electoral resonance of the China issue in the American campaign. I don't think there is, but they're playing all cards at this point. It's also important to point out, as Dove did, that this is bipartisan. Schumer and Menendez just dropped a $350 billion bill to beef up the American industrial and technology base, in part directly to compete with China. And I don't think the bill is necessarily going to go anywhere this year, but they are staking out territory that maybe Biden doesn't want to say or talk about, but certainly fits with him. My only caveat on the bill that they have put down that I've seen so far is that they want to spend $16 billion in support for the semiconductor industrial base in the United States. Having lived through an attempt to do just such a thing back in the 1990s, I can tell you that's probably the biggest waste of money I can imagine in a bill. But that suggests the bipartisan quality of the China escalation on the American side that's going on right now, regardless of what the Chinese themselves are doing.
For my part, Taiwan is a model democracy in the region, and the United States and nations across the region have to do a better job supporting it, no matter what Beijing has to say about it, because and how nations around the world have behaved and companies around the world have behaved is utterly deplorable as they've bent their principles to Beijing's will. Byron, start us off. Regular weekly segment. We're going to end every Friday on what to expect and what to plan for in the coming week. One input from everybody. Why don't you start us off on what we should be paying attention to in the week to come so that everybody is best prepared when the morning gun goes off on Monday?
Well, next week, I think center stage will be the Marine Corps. The modern day Marine is being held this year virtually. The Commandant will speak on Wednesday morning. And I think it's going to be interesting because I forget in this broadcast, it was Dove or Gordon just mentioned, you know, he really has introduced some very interesting concepts about how the Marines need to change for a contingency in the Indo-Pacific. And that has all sorts of ramifications for not only the Marines, but the Navy and actually the Army as well, too. There's going to be a hearing as well that the Senate Armed Services Committee is going to be holding on Navy and Marine Corps readiness. And the other thing that I'm going to keep an eye on is Michael O'Hanlon at Brookings is going to be holding an event, I think September 25th, with the two leading members on the House on the Future Defense Task Force. This is a briefing that I think it'll be a bipartisan look at, what should be the future of defense. We'll keep an eye out for that, too.
I was just going to say, expect more details to come out regarding where the Office of the Secretary and the Secretary himself are going to wind up being on this Navy issue. It's not clear whether next week will be the week that they come out with some kind of unclassified piece of paper. But in light of the Esper speech, I think you'll see more and more details coming out, either from Navy sources or from OSD sources or from Congress.
Gordon?
I think on the budgetary side, we're going to see probably within the next week is the CR get sharpened, identified, and whistle through the Congress so fast it'll make your head spin. I actually am optimistic that there's going to be some movement forward on a stimulus package, including the state and local funding at some level, because now we're at the stage where we're arguing about the numbers and not about the principle. And the more interesting, unpredictable thing is whether this trail of former Trump officials who are now endorsing Biden continues to unroll over the next week. Everybody seems to be sitting around waiting to see what John Kelly decides he's going to do, for example.
Chris, and then Mackenzie to wrap up.
tangential to what the group talked about. Early voting starts here in Virginia and other states. I'm interested to see what sort of trends the media and folks that watch that closely will glean from the early voting numbers and how that plays into the messaging that we talked about and you know what sort of pivoting it will create. But you know all of the stuff that everyone has said is certainly stuff to keep an eye on.
And obviously, right, Gordon, what you were talking about was the revelation by Mike Pence's, one of Mike Pence's senior advisors on coronavirus criticizing, Ms. Troy criticizing.
Correct, Olivia Troy's statement.
Mm-hmm. The president. Mackenzie, last word before we part.
If the listeners have not had enough Air Force news for 1 week following the AFA conference and the many headlines coming out of that, and some of it was behind a paywall, so maybe perhaps you didn't get enough. Next Tuesday, Defense One will host a State of the Air Force discussion with the new chief of staff, followed by a panel with yours truly at 3 o'clock on Tuesday virtual. So tune in for that and join us.
Terrific. Thanks very much, everybody. Really appreciate it. Happy New Year, Shana Tova, or I should say, may everybody have a good New Year. And certainly looking forward to having you guys back again next week. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Vago.
Thank you, Vago.
Shana Tova to all.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.